hook makes the roots of Velma's hair tighten. He swung his club over his shoulder like a back scratcher and is all for abandoning the ball in favor of the cards, which is what the two invited them over for. But Jan is still trying to coax him out of the sand trap. It's not about sisters being uptight, Robert, or white folks being uptight. It's about the boy himself. Old man Riley is so old, and that boy's been to all those white schools, white camps. Robert is considering a bank shot off the legs of the chair. Ruby reviews her freshman math, but Robert buries the club head in the carpet, folds his hands, and gives Jan his attention. I always took you for your word, Robert. Nation building. Jan's whispering, realizing finally that she might have done this in private, but Velma appreciating finally why she didn't. And don't forget to build the inner nation, Robert.
The nation,
Robert says, checks his watch and takes his shot. I don't believe this, Ruby snorts, and Velma pushes a pillow in her face. It's like trying to build a bowl when you haven't got the clay properly centered, Jan was saying after Robert left the house, confident that all agreed on a common reference for it. It'll rise, it'll flare, it'll look good for a minute, but it'll wobble and tear. It won't stand up.
Who you telling?
Ruby was on her feet, wrestling a chunk of air onto a wheel of similar substance.
Yeah, like trying to get this bowl done without doing a scientific analysis of the objective conditions and primary issues.
Ruby, quit.
Or taking a serious position on the woman question, the national question, the gay question, the so forth and so on questions.
Just stop, Ruby.
It's a case of little red henism, most of the time. Notice how fewer and fewer people are ready to build. Hence, my bowl here is jeopardized.
Velma and Jan laughing and holding each other while Ruby wrestles the bowl in the air, her head wagging no, no, miming with each spin the tear that was growing more critical, the lump that was curling the lip of the bowl over in a sneer.
Your performance just does not make me feel good, Ruby.
She's perverse, Velma. She was on the piano stool with the baby in her lap. They were turning, getting taller, her feet farther and farther away from the pedals, the baby riding, his legs round her waist. And James was at the desk editing the Academy manual, and Mama May was sitting in the horsehair Chesterfield, chanting in that way of hers.
Darling. When my dear told me the news, I fell on my knees and cried, Glory! It's a beautiful thing!
She was misting up, and the fact that she'd passed up the opportunity to emphasize that she'd had to get the news from my dear about the adoption made Velma misty, too.
Lord, all them babies inside all them places waiting on us to bring 'em on home.
And Velma was turning slowly on the stool, smiling at Mama May, smiling at the baby there was no name for yet, big as he was. Then James, standing, turned toward the window, arms wide to the sun, then turned toward her and the baby.
I orient myself, he smiled.
I deoxident myself,
she answered. A private joke whose origins they'd forgotten, and Mama May frowned, leaning over to take her grandson from its funny-talking mama.
Health is my right,
Velma finally said with some clarity, no longer reeling and rocking on the stool. Her eyes were opening, and the healer's hands were patting her.
My right,
she said again. Just what so many patients maintained indignantly when the bill came. The original statement had been more than done in bas relief over the infirmary archway.
more than 100 years ago by carpenters, smiths, and other artisans celebrated throughout the district in song, story, and recipe, and immortalized finally in 8-foot-high figures of eye-stinging colors on the east wall of the Academy of the Seven Arts. Those black men of old who had flat-out refused to haul them stones another further, no matter what the surveyors and others standing about with pipes experts had to say on the subject of gradients and silt and faults and soil mold. 'Cause the stars said, and the energy belts led, and the cards read, and the cowries spread, and the wise ones reared back in their rockers, spat a juicy brown glob into a can, shaded their eyes and took a reading of the sun, and then pointed that spot and none other. So, the Southwest Community Infirmary, established 1871 by the Free Coloreds of Claiborne, went up on its spot and none other at the base of Gaylord Hill, directly facing the Mason's Lodge, later the Fellowship Hall, where the elders of the district arbitrated affairs, and now the academy where the performing arts, the martial arts, the medical arts, the scientific arts, and the arts and humanities were taught without credit and drew from the ranks of workers, dropouts, students, housewives, ex-cons, vets, church folk, professionals, an alarming number of change agents as they insisted on calling themselves. The infirmary at the base of the hill, its north windows looking out toward the post office that had gone up on the first bluff where cars, buses and trucks shifted gear for the second pull-up, and the infirmary's sun deck overlooking the regal theater marquee, which jutted out so close to the curb, bold children on the school buses would lean out on a dare and snatch bulbs or remove letters from the racks, leaving baffling announcements, while the driver shifted gears for the final pull up to Gaylord Heights, where a fountain ought to have been, or a plaza for couples to promenade about on Sunday afternoons, or a public garden with a pond and some of the statuary on exhibit in the halls of the academy should have been. But where stood, like a sentinel, the gaslight in front of the wrought iron gate of the Russell Estate, eager to annex unto itself the whole of Gaylord Hill, the prime real estate of black turf that ended somewhere between the lane, where the bus turned, carrying away the chemical plant workers and Heights domestics and the school children, and the mailbox some 600 feet below the gaslight. The flame in a nervous flicker, always. Fire going out, animals closing in, the tongue of the flame darting, striking at the globe. Each year, a new globe to replace the one shattered not by the fang-like flame, but by the bus riders just before turning into the lane. Each year, a globe more ornate and preposterous than the last, as if the Russells were convinced it was their manifest burden to bear the torch, to bring light to the natives of Gaylord Hill. It was said, though, in the stories, songs, jokes, and riddles of the district, that the lamp was not gas, but electric, and drew upon the power line that fed the Regal and the rest of the establishments of the hill, that, of course, had to foot the bill, and wasn't that just the way? And more than one community sage would look toward the Heights on viewing the dimming halo of the Regal's marquee on foggy nights or upon hearing the groan as the infirmary switched to its own generators, power from the main line dwindling, would nudge a kid and point toward the top of the hill and explain their worldwide program, their destiny, young blood, is to drain the juices and to put out the lights, and don't you forget it. When the scaffolding went up in the spring of 1871, the stonemasons mounted the face of the infirmary to chip free from the chosen stones all manner of messages responsibles might read to their charges, some messages written out to be read by anybody who'd mastered the alphabet, others, more finely carved and worked over, to be read by initiates of the order only. Those self-same secrets of alchemy attempted in the carvings of Notre Dame miles away from the seat of knowing. Those self-same instructions of the arcana, burned, buried, smothered in the cradle, but persistent. Those self-same knowledges and mnemonics sacked, plundered, perverted. But over the infirmary arch, all of it pure, insistent, and when new, had urged the originals to transverse the globe to share the wisdoms with the peoples of the Solomons, the Philippines, the China Seas, the Indian Ocean, Mexico, Europe, Arabia, Mesopotamia, the neighbors who'd been set adrift at the splitting of Pangaea. All of it gazing down in stony insistence on Dr. Julius Meadows, standing on the steps, looking over his shoulder at the paint job in the halls of the infirmary. White, white, with a flush of pink, like an udder left too long without milking. "That's my country self talking," Dr. Meadows frowned, coming down the steps. And it was his country self admiring the tabby wall that wrapped around the back of the infirmary, holding the woods off. And it was his country self wanting to set foot on the crushed oyster shell walkways that led to the sheds where the generator hummed. Looking up, he saw merely sandstone faces, wheels, five-sided puzzles, basalt, grape clusters, bricks and coils that could be snakes to the fanciful of mind. Figures, glyphs, warnings, bricks, carvings, arches. It was all the same to him. A building. He looked toward the curtains of the treatment room, then turned his back, blushing. For the idea of actually making a journey through the woods in search of two catatonic women branded him a fool in his city mind. Dr. Meadows moved quickly toward the avenue as if with purpose, trying to make some sense of his behavior earlier, his actions now. Reviewing the Hippocratic Oath after all this time, it was peculiar, a compulsion. He had wanted to call them out. Dialogue with those beings behind the names, know the gods he'd given allegiance to. To converse with one's principles seemed both the height of sophistication and the height of ridiculousness at the same time. Seemed primitive. Seemed. He lost his point, and then lost himself among the children out of school, adults out of work, shoppers, workers from the chemical plant's second shift, smudged and smelly and in search of a quick bite to eat. There seemed to be a contest going on between the record shop and the neighboring bar, an ear-splitting electronic version of an old Wild Bill Doggett piece he had once danced to, hitting him at his back, and a spastic rock piece he'd never heard assaulted him head-on. "Band of Thieves," he tagged the first group, and it was getting so he had to look hard at the musicians on the bandstand when he went into a club these days. The white boys had it down. "Chinese band," he labeled the latter, as his father had called the group he'd planned to hook up with. "A bunch of opium heads." So Meadows had gone to medical school. "We need to bring scientific thinking to the masses," a kid in a Levi suit was haranguing his buddies, the youths marching along, four abreast. Meadows had to step into the street and walk around a parking meter to avoid getting hit by their book satchels. "The masses are still reacting out of infantile emotionalism." "Mostly, it's diet," maintained the one who had almost broken Meadows' kneecap. "Diet and stress." "Is that right?" An indignant drunk, snatching at the passing satchel, was challenging the four young men to a talk-off. But they continued on and left the man reeling. So once again, Meadows moved toward the curb. This time, he was stopped by a group of skinny old men in shirt sleeves leaning up against a coupe de ville, eyeing three young girls dancing in the middle of the street, swinging a red plastic tape recorder back and forth as in a relay race.
"I feel so sanctified."
"Before you can get sanctified, girly, you got to be saved."
"Save your breath, Shaky B. Can't tell these young girls a thing."
The third man was squinting, like he was in need of an aspirin. It was Meadows' guess that he simply wanted his cronies to shut up so he could watch the girls in peace.
"How you get saved?"
one of the girls asked in mock seriousness, arms out like the radio was a kid's sister she was swinging. The quiet man with the headache appealed to Meadows. Couldn't he make everybody be quiet and just enjoy the floor show? The girl asking the question had superb tits, Meadows noticed.
"How you get saved?"
she asked again, her head to the side as if she didn't know she had magnificent tits, as if that was not why she wore her crushed leather belt like a tourniquet.
"I seriously want to know."
"Surrender."
"Surrender?"
She rolled her eyes and did a snaky move with her hips the headache man fully enjoyed.
"What kind of surrender?"
She was looking straight at Meadows. Meadows thought it wise to cross the street.
"Surrender? Counter-revolutionary batshit,"
said the skinnier of the three girls, imitating someone who evidently wore a cap with a bill, for she mimed the yanking down of a cap as she spoke.
"Surrender is anti-struggle,"
she announced in this other person's voice, making the third girl giggle, but Meadows doubted she knew why.
"Is that what they're teaching you at school these days?"
The man was shrugging off the headache man's hand, plucking at his sleeve.
"To curse your elders."
"Oh, man, it's spring and it don't cost us anything to enjoy all the pretty flowers. Why you want to get overheated?"
Headache pleaded.
"Wait up now. I ain't through talking to you."
"We through listening, lest you got some money,"
Tits said.
"I got some money."
Headache spoke right up, both hands digging in his pockets.
"What you got?"
The other two had shot past him, but the brazen one was once again looking Meadows square in his mouth.
"Gloria, check this out. Ever seen a nigger blushing?"
"He a nigger?"
Meadows crossed back over to the other side, wondering why he was putting himself through all these changes. But it had been so long since he had simply walked in a black neighborhood, been among so many black people. He wished he knew someone in Claiborne he could call up and invite for a drink, or call up and be invited for dinner.
"Supper. Supper."
He mouthed the word, relished it. There was an elderly man at the bus stop greeting the passers-by. He looked like Meadows imagined his grandfather had looked. He laughed and showed his bridge work. He looked like a man who might be interesting to have supper with. Meadows was tempted to take the bus, strike up a conversation, and... But then there was a sidewalk cafe coming up where two good-looking women were eating salad out of one plate with their fingers and talking, enjoying themselves. A nice place with chinaware and amber-colored glasses and silverware that shone. Not at all what he'd have expected to find in this neighborhood. He thought about sitting down and having a glass of white wine, but in front of the entranceway was a group of young men and women so intent upon what a tall man with a bow tie bobbing at his throat had to say that they wouldn't make room for him.
"I'm not here to boogie, but to jolt you back into your original right minds."
"You a dreamer, mister."
A woman coming out of the cafe, stuffing an apron into her handbag, broke through the group and bagged Meadows up against the white ironwork fencing.
She looked like she knew a thing or two, it seemed to him, at least about how to make an opening for herself.
"Dreamer," she sighed, looking straight at Meadows as though they'd spoken of just this topic at breakfast and she would now take his arm and they would go home together. She was looking at him, and then she wasn't, had moved on, and Meadows changed his mind about the wine. He continued toward the corner, hearing the voice of the tall man in bow tie clear over the heads of the crowd.
"History is calling us to rule again, and you lost dead souls are standing around doing the freaky dicky." And adjusting his pace to each beat in the traffic, people scurrying or dawdling or bumping into each other, dreaming along the pavement. "Never recognizing the teachers come among you to prepare you for the transformation. Never recognizing the synthesizers come to forge the new alliances, or the guides who throw open the new footpaths, or the messengers come to end all excuses. Dreamer, the dream is real, my friends. The failure to make it work is the unreality."
Meadows was out of earshot, but the words still resonated. His city and his country mind drew together to ponder it all.
As Dr. Arias is wont to say, "Butch, the most confounding labyrinth of all is a straight line."
Doc Surge was holding forth.
"Buster," the boy muttered, glancing around him, embarrassed by his surroundings.
"Take money. If you want it, getting it is the easiest thing in the world. One need understand just a few simple principles that govern supply and demand. Understand, the problem is not to get it, but to stop getting into a funk about wanting it. Going all around Robin's barn, dodging and fainting, trying to justify the appetite. Simple laws is all. Laws as inexorable as gravity. But they don't teach basic principles in the schools. So people have no discipline about living. They have no religion. You hear me talking to you?"
"Yes, sir."
"And what is religion, you might ask? It's a technology of living. And what do I mean by technology? The study and application of the laws that govern events in our lives. Just that. Now, take one of the first principles, supply and demand."
Buster knew he wouldn't get what he came for. He might just as well have stayed in the healing room. All he wanted to know for his paper was what pageant the Brotherhood planned to do for the spring festival. The rumor was they were going to reenact an old slave insurrection. The writing workshop at the academy had been working on a script, he knew, about the rebellion that had taken place on the Russell and Alcorn plantations just days before Harper's Ferry. And one of his classmates, who'd offered to work with him on the term project and then changed her mind, had already interviewed Sophie Haywood, who was said to be the great-great-something of the boarding house keeper who had bankrolled the uprising and, together with another boarding house keeper from the coast called Pleasance, was prepared to bankroll the original plan for Harper's Ferry, which was to arm the slaves. But then John Brown had broken discipline, as the brothers at the academy would say, and Harriet Tubman and Fred Douglas stepped back. "You got it, white boy. Run it." And the boarding house women had taken their money and booked. Sitting there on the stepladder, trying to keep towels from falling on his head and trying to keep his hands off the stacks of soap he wouldn't mind pocketing, it occurred to him that there was no reason why Dr. Surge should tell him what had always been kept secret until the very last minute. Only the Brotherhood, the sons, grandsons, and nephews of what years ago had been the Mardi Gras Society, before gangs, then drugs, busted up the network, knew what route the parade would take to the park and knew what skit would be performed as the main event of the festival. The most anybody else could find out was the general look of the costumes, or at least the colors of the various families or tribes or gangs or clubs. He'd tried asking around the academy, but brothers his own age said right to his face that his paper was dumb, and that he should be working with one of the committees if he wanted to get into something hip. He'd tried to approach Obi. Figuring as a neighbor and all, he might help. He'd listened, but then he'd pretty much said the same thing, that the committees were hurting for workers. There was a research team working up a paper to take to the UN, a petition, as was Malcolm's directive. And there was a fundraising team pledged to contribute so much toward the formation of a black commission of inquiry to dig further into COINTELPRO. And there was a group that had shown him a petition calling for a safe earth. He supposed all of that was important, but he was just trying to get his paper together and do the student thing. His instructor wanted the first draft in the morning.
"You've got good skills, and you've got drive," one of the brothers from the karate studio had told him. But just when Buster had thought he had an ally, the brother had added, "But skills and drive without consciousness and purpose make you dangerous, man. Dangerous to the community." And he'd turned his back on Buster to shadowbox in the mirror. Then Obi and another dude, Nadine's uncle, had sent them to talk to, a marriage counselor, no less, started piling papers on him. Amnesty International, UN Charter on Human Rights, COINTELPRO, the Freedom of Information Act, Panthers, RAM, IRS, AIM, Attica, the Wilmington 10, the Charlotte 3, the FBI, the CIA, but not a scrap of anything about what he'd come for. The most he could get out of his cousin Ruby, who never stopped feeding papers into the copier and moving back and forth between phones and tables and baskets and clipboards, saying she had no time to talk, had to go open her shop, was that thinking seriously on insurrection might just set the future in motion. He'd written it down, not sure if she was putting him on or not. One never knew with Ruby. And he'd filed through the material they loaded him down with. Maybe when he got to editorial writing, the stuff might come in handy. Buster changed positions on the stepladder and glanced at the doodles and scribbles on his notepad as if considering how to take down what Doc was lecturing about. He'd never become a good journalist. He never got what he went after. Maybe he'd just make up something. His instructor wouldn't know the difference. Probably couldn't care less. Which was exactly the decision an equally demoralized young man who was using the name Donaldson had come to, sipping flat beer at the sidewalk cafe less than a block away. There'd been no word on the street about the armory heist, no lead anywhere on who might be sitting on the cache of rifles. And trying to infiltrate the academy was not that simple, he'd tried to explain. Those guys were close blood relatives, had grown up together, had ties from way back, and the women were not a type he'd run across before. Played everything close to the chest, didn't open up. The times were different. A few years ago, picking up info, picking brains, was the easiest thing in the world. Everybody was running off at the mouth at the drop of the hat, eager for a press conference at any time of day or night. Things were different now. With his record, it was not likely he'd be invited to go to school, get trained, become a regular. The Special Police Task Force and the FBI recruited openly now on the black campuses, set up booths even during career week. What did they need with him? He laughed in his beer, and here he was, ready, willing, and able. But how was he going to get onto a campus with his record? So how could he get anywhere unless he came up with a solid tip, a big one? 5 days and nights Donaldson had been on the street, smoking out every breezy mouth in town, laid his super deluxe wrap on 3 foxes up at the academy, spread what little bread he had around, hoping to spring something loose. Nothing. Less than nothing. Trouble. He'd almost blown it.
so anxious to pull from the joker in the pit stop diner who had seemed to know a lot about the vets who ran the academy's sports programs for the kids and the vets being prime suspects, Donaldson had aroused suspicion. It had taken quite a bit of fast thinking on his feet to cover himself when the joker started asking him where he'd grown up, what kind of work he did in Claiborne, who'd he know, where'd he hang out, and some fancy footwork to cover his tracks when the man turned up on page one face down on the diner floor. But what to report? What did he have to turn in? He could make something up. He'd done that before. Hell, it was done all the time. Even the pros did it when sources dried up. They'd already made their minds up anyway. He knew who they were after, and the bloods up at the academy were probably the ones anyway. So what the hell? He'd wing it. Decided. Done. Buster had not as yet made his decision. Doc had turned suddenly, interrupting his train of thought, and leaned out the door of the linen closet.
Bantu Boute, hey, hey.
Doc had hooked one arm around the shelf divider and was leaning his body against the doorknob, flirting with the nurses in the hall.
We're going to report you, Doc.
Who to? I'm the man in the shoes around here, hey, hey, hey.
Doc seemed to have forgotten all about him, looking ready to stroll out after the women. Buster was not prepared to sit there and wait. It was all kind of stupid anyway, trying to get an interview in a linen closet, and there wasn't time for much delay. Doc was due in the auditorium soon as old Lady Ransom did her thing. He examined his notes. All Doc had talked about was money.
Now, you take that little one with the test tube rack,
Doc Surge was saying, gesturing for Buster to come to the door or at least lean forward.
A pathologist. More to the point, a hummingbird. Looks fragile, but those dainty wings can carry her on some long-distance flights on some long-distance nights. All she needs is good management.
Sir. Buster had stood up, then sat back down. Doc Surge turned and resumed his position, one elbow on the shelf with the pillowcases, one elbow opposite against a pile of blankets, one crane leg crooked in front of the other. All he needed was a straw hat and a cane.
Some doctor.
But then he wasn't a real doctor, Buster reminded himself. He ran the infirmary, kept it going, and they called him Doc, just as years ago when he ran a gambling joint his father had told him about. They called him Pharaoh. What his father had not told him, but Buster had found out after some snooping, was that he'd had a few other names in his day, like Candyman and Sweet Bear.
I don't care who you are or what your aspiration, doctor, poet, elevator operator, milkman, barber, reporter, it pays to study the law. And I don't mean the man's law. Course that pays, too. I mean the law. The problem with the man is that he always gets half the story and then bungles it. Dates right back to the Greeks. They go to all that trouble to ransack Alexandria and then blow it, fumble the ball, miss the message.
Equal before the law.
Fine.
Bet you think you know what that means.
Buster shrugged while the man unbuttoned his jacket, jerked his wrists free of his cuffs, took up a cake of soap in one hand and presented it to his audience, took up a blanket roll in the other with a flourish.
See these? One black, one white.
Yes, sir.
Doc held his gaze for an uncomfortably long time. Buster met it, but it was a strain to keep still and not shift his eyes. It was a pity Doc didn't have a bigger audience. He was too much for one. He let go, and the roll and the soap hit the floor.
Notice.
Buster noticed that the soap shattered and the floor was a mess. He noted that the blanket roll had come undone.
He wasn't sure what else he was supposed to be observing.
Landed at the same time. That's a quality in the law. In the law. Nature's law. Gravity, Butch.
Buster.
Now, take supply and demand. You probably think you know that one. Studied it in high school economics class, right?
And I bet you think it has something to do with capitalist economics, right? He wasn't waiting for answers or any other kind of response.
Has very, very little to do with capitalist economics. More to do with the ministry, with marriage, with...
pimping?
Buster was feeling brave. He doubted that anyone had ever dared to get that familiar with Doc Surge about his past. But the man had gotten into his business, hadn't he? Come right to his house and sat him down with his father and launched into a long rap about Nadine and the baby.
Does it occur to you that that baby you are considering aborting might be the very one who will deliver us?
That had worked fine with his father, but had cut no ice with Buster and his mother. Buster still maintained the baby wasn't his.
What difference does that make? Doc had argued. Law of averages says you take care of this one, some other young man will wind up taking care of yours, and so forth.
His mother had called that sheer illogic and left the house. Buster had to admit he'd been grateful for the visit, though, because shortly after that, Nadine's uncle had come by with a pistol. And while Thurston had a rep for being a very reasonable and peaceful type, the type that usually could be depended on to cool out the hotheads on LaSalle Street, still, there was no telling what he might have done, given that Nadine was not only his niece, but more a daughter.
Yeah, like pimping,
Doc said, not skipping a beat.
A woman in the hands of an undisciplined player is very nearly as dangerous a situation to all concerned as atomic energy in the hands of capitalists, as any kind of power in the hands of the psychically immature, spiritually impoverished, and intellectually undisciplined. He was warming to his subject, had unbuttoned his vest, and changed the position of his legs.
Yeah, pimpin' too. If you're going to be a player, and not just some moochin' miscreant and misuser of women and women's knowledges, you've got to study the principles that govern the game.
It might have been a paper he was delivering at a national conference on physics.
Buster was beginning to enjoy the performance. Doc held out his hand, or rather held it up out of the pillowcases, and wagged one finger at a time. Principles such as the law of reciprocity, the principle of attraction and repulsion, good old supply and demand, again. His watch was now in view, and Buster sensed this could go on for hours.
Sir, what I wanted to know, and I realize your time is short and all, what I'm doing my report about.
I'm getting to that.
Okay. If you are not curious about the difference between a prime player and a mere pussy peddler, then let me come at this another way, Butch, because it is important to understand the basis for the Brotherhood and its activities. No sense half knowing a thing, because half knowing is not sufficient. Look at the mess the half knowers have got this country in, got this world in. Now check this out. Fishing a dollar bill out of his watch pocket. No Latin, Butch?
Buster.
No, sir.
The man thought the new age and the new order began with his arrival on these shores.
Ha! They convinced us they knew about this country's manifest destiny. Clearly, they were totally ignorant about its latent destiny, its occult destiny. Understand? Now, its latent destiny is a Neptunian thing, a black thing, an us thing. Following?
He waved the dollar until Buster leaned forward and took it, examined it.
and the new age has only just begun to be ushered in. So to understand the depth of the question you so nonchalantly ask about the Brotherhood, you need to understand many things about the times. Do you know what time it is? Buster was not about to go for the chump bait and look at his watch and then have the man yell "dummy" at him in a linen closet. It's the third year of the last quarter of the 20th century, buddy. A very crucial moment in human history. 6 years. 6 short years away from 1984. And I don't mean Orwell. The last quarter, he was examining his manicure, it seemed, and deciding, evidently, to change manicurists. You play basketball, so you know a lot can happen in the last quarter. All sorts of surprises, upsets, right?
Yes, sir. Well, all right.
Now he was lifting his pocket watch up like a yo-yo. Maybe it wasn't as late as Buster had thought. Maybe the wristwatch was just a piece of jewelry, something he wore to complete his ensemble, and the vest pocket timepiece, the functional piece. Though what would complete the picture, Buster was thinking, studying the three-piece suit, the vest, tie, pocket hanky, was a gun holster. Administrator or no, Doc Surge always dressed like a first-class gangster in a foreign movie. There was probably a slouched-down white hat that went with this suit. It's late. I'm due in the auditorium in less than 5 minutes, if I read Miss Ransom right. Now, buddy, if you're half the young man I take you for, you'll track down Dr. Arias, who is one shrewd cookie, and then, if you're smart and very, very lucky, you'll try to see the hermit. He was fastening his vest and jacket now and shaking down his sleeves. You did say you wanted to talk with Cleotus Brown.
Yes, sir.
Well, dismissed. Doc Surge sucked in so the student could squeeze past, and it was just as he'd said. The kid was half the man he took him for. He left without asking where Dr. Arias might be found or how to get to see the hermit. Doc watched him go down the hall and brushed his ring against his chin, and it was just as Cleotus had said. There was no charge, no tension, no stuff in these young people's passage. They walked by you, and there was no breeze of merit, no vibes. Open them up, and you might find a skate key, or a peach pit, or a Mary Jane wrapper, or a slinky, but that would be about all. Or maybe you'd find something totally unidentifiable. Might just as well be aliens from another planet, definitely directed by energies from elsewhere. Doc felt momentarily deficient. He knew a lot of things, but he was nonplussed by the new people. New, unattached, unobliged. They were either adrift or freed up. It was difficult to figure. And the new women were even more confounding than the men. He couldn't do a thing with them. He no longer trusted his knowledge of their language of gesture and rhythm. When he walked up to groups of young women at the academy talking with each other, he felt an intruder, felt he was missing their timing somewhere. But this was not his province. Sophie and Cleotis had the gift in that area. His gift was managing the infirmary. Doc patted down his bush, raked among the silver hairs around his ears, and strolled out of the linen closet as if stepping from the barber shop fresh and fragrant. He needed to look in on Minnie and tell her to shake a leg. It wasn't like her to run overtime like this. He would do the abridged version of his lecture for the visiting medical folk, for this was the night he did his rounds on LaSalle Street like Doc John among the lepers. Doc listened to the smart click-click of his Spanish boots on the tiles. He nodded toward the maintenance crew in such a way as to signal he didn't much appreciate their lollygagging around the juice bar. He bowed deeply whenever he met one of the women workers he thought needed his special brand of attentiveness. He headed in the general direction of the treatment room, feeling that familiar wave of energy surge through him.
In another minute, he sensed he would generate enough energy to found a dynasty, lift a truck, start a war, light up the whole of Claiborne for a week.
"I am one beautiful and powerful son of a bitch," he told himself. "Smart as a whip, respected, prosperous, beloved, and valuable, I have the right to be healthy, happy, and rich, for I am the baddest player in this arena or any other. I love myself more than I love money and pretty women and fine clothes. I love myself more than I love neat gardens and healthy babies and a good gospel choir. I love myself as I love the law. I love myself in error and in correctness, waking or sleeping, sneezing, tipsy, or fabulously brilliant. I love myself doing the books or sitting down to do a good game of poker. I love myself making love expertly or tenderly and shyly or clumsily and inept. I love myself as I love the master's mind." He continued his litany, having long ago stumbled upon the prime principle as a player, that self-love produces the gods, and the gods are genius. It took genius to run the Southwest Community Infirmary, so he made the rounds of his hospital the way he used to make the rounds of his houses, to keep the tops spinning, reciting declarations of self-love.
6. Holding onto the rail to get off the bus, Palma didn't have time to see him, to prepare herself, to throw open her arms, or to wonder how he'd gotten there ahead of her. There was no time to get her mind working. Had Marcus received her wire, or happened to be in Claiborne for a different reason, and was at the bus terminal to meet someone else? When she stepped down to the bottom step in rocky terror, gazing down at the pegged jeans, the green lacquered toenails, the Carmen Miranda shoes, looking down in disbelief, could this be her in this getup? She was being lifted. And all the step-by-step to do the minute I hit town went right out of her head. She never quite touched the curbstone, and she didn't quite get a look at him before she smelled him and felt him, the faint vanilla fragrance, warm and custardy, his soap under the bite of citrus, the shaving cologne she'd never liked, the agri beads on chewed leather around his neck imprinting themselves on her sternum, then his chin so sharp in her neck, his beard scraping her cheek raw. He was hurting her. Or maybe she was crying because she was that glad to be home and to find him there. Or maybe the crying was fear, his presence confirming what she'd been dreading about Velma, that something terrible had happened to her sister. The morning before, Palma had run across a photo of her sister among the sheet music and been stunned, scared, a photo she'd never seen. Velma in shorts and halter squinting into the camera, her arms turned out so that the unsunned and exposed insides showed childlike and vulnerable, as if waiting for the shock of the alcoholed cotton and the sting of the needle, and such tension in the hunched shoulders, the neck, the torso. Palma had dropped it, and the photo had curled up tight on the floor like a white pencil. It had taken effort to flatten it out again to examine closely. Velma's face a blur, but the eyeballs black and sharp as though someone had stabbed her there with a black felt pen. Rigid, fearful, Velma had looked insane, her bush spiked out like the bromeliad behind her, the knife-like red buds the plant shot out like flames, like a jagged halo. It was an old photo, taken the summer before at the beginning of Velma's comings and goings, of her complaints that Obie and Lil James were driving her nuts.
talking in an odd way but never quite explaining what the matter was, complaining about sexual harassment on the job, but not offering an example in that stand-up comic way she had. No anecdotes, just her reaction, and not saying why all this should be getting to her at this late date. There was nothing new about Obie's ambivalence. Should he and Velma hire help to do the mother act? Or should Velma and maybe both of them cut back on community work? Or the boys' vacillation, 1 minute a responsible teenager, the next a crybaby, the next a rebellious kid. And there was certainly nothing new about supervisors trying to do the shakedown samba. And since summer, Velma was getting more and more tense, leaving her house with larger and larger suitcases, popping into Palma's at odd hours, coming to the breakfast table wrapped in pieced-together bedclothes, sweatshirt, rain poncho, most anything, and walking like a board, mumbling about a migraine or a nightmare or some ill-defined bad feeling she could not shake. She'd pace the kitchen, unable to bend and sit down, it seemed, until Palma got the kids off to school and could run a tub for her to soak. The morning the troop were due in Barnwell for the No Nukes rally, Velma had come to the table, stiff-necked and silent, and bitten right through her juice glass. The photo, the stiffness, the blood-red flowers, had triggered in Palma the dream of the night before. Velma spitting splattered teeth into a rusty can whose ragged lid cut her lips, and Palma had rushed to the phone. Had Velma remembered to rinse her mouth out with warm salt water, remembered to see a doctor? Palma, hanging on the phone, reliving the panic, the tedium of removing bits of glass from tongue and gums with her tweezers, reliving the rush with a dish towel full of cracked ice and ignoring the looks of her children. Palma, one hand holding the phone, the other stretching out the scrolled photo, surrendered up to the flood of dream fragments, premonitions, replays of conversations.
"Do you think, Palma, that suicides reincarnate more quickly than, say..."
She was crowded off her chair. And then her period stopped abruptly.
"Hey."
He dug her chin out of the folds of his sweater and kissed it.
"It's only me, baby. Marcus. Everything'll be all right."
He handed her his handkerchief. He was laughing. She felt it ripple against her stomach, but she felt worry in his chest, felt a drop in the heat of his breath. She shivered. She didn't have time to ask him any of the questions forming in her mouth. Had he seen Velma? Heard anything? Was Obie in town? Had Marcus gone by her house? Were her children all right? Had there been a burglary or a fire in the apartment? Had Velma moved back to her own house and simply forgotten to have her calls transferred from Palma's place? Had she changed jobs again without notifying personnel? Was everything really all right? No time. Cecile and Mai were off the bus now, crowding her, waiting to be introduced, kissing her goodbye, trying to make room for the other passengers waiting to pull their luggage out of the storage compartment.
"We'll meet up later at your place, yes? The program begins in the park at midnight."
"But first we eat, Mai," Cecile was insisting.
Palma tried to handle the introductions, stumbling over their names, her voice catching. The look of Nilda and Cecile so altered she could not quite get her bearings. Chesia and Inez pulling the women on in the direction of the avocado pit.
"Health food?"
Cecile appealed over her shoulder to Palma.
"Don't let them serve me no sick girl lunch, please. I want pig, I want conch, fungi, ackee."
"Good food,"
Nilda and Chesia were saying, hustling Cecile on to give the lovers space.
"I don't favor plant life sandwiches with cobwebs. Palma, direct us to the place of the Sidioso chefs."
Marcus quickly pointed out Alex's barbecue, and then his hand returned to the shivery place on Palma's shoulder. He held on to her until she gave him his handkerchief back.
"Marcus, my period stopped."
She watched him hear it, watched him wait, mull it over, and wait. That was not the way to say it, but how to explain the moony womb and the shedding of skin on schedule? How to explain the pull of Velma, the tug of her clock compelling? How to relay the alarm? Last Monday, she awoke suddenly, wondering whether she could get the posters, the flyers, and the t-shirts into the duffel bag. But when she opened her closet door, there was Velma in an old leotard of hers and a kitchen curtain draped like a sarong and rummaging among sheets, pillowcases, fabric, shoeboxes in search of a tampon or a sanitary pad. Then later, the morning and afternoon spent packing, checking the slides, marking the poster rolls, Palma's period arrived 8 days early. Not surprising. It always happened that way. When the children complained that Aunt Velma's sudden appearances on the sofa or in the bathroom or in the family budget were jarring, that her visits completely wrecked the order of the house and everybody's timetable, Palma had smiled, but yes. Monday and then Wednesday, Marcus. Just 1.5 days. She tried again and felt him waiting, worried, his hands pressing her shoulders toward him. How to explain the dread on Wednesday in Barnwell when the flow had stopped abruptly, no sign, no stains, no bloated feeling, nothing. And then not being able to reach Velma at the apartment, the house, the job. The kids haven't seen her since Monday night, Marcus. But that didn't explain much either. Velma often contracted with out-of-town computer jobbers or worked odd hours on terminals all over the city, and the kids had their own peculiar schedules. He was pulling her slightly to him if she wanted to come, but she didn't. Not yet.
Velma?
He was studying her face, and she was straining to push to its surface the terror she hadn't been able to articulate.
Marcus, something has happened to Velma.
He didn't say that something was always happening to Velma, that her dogmatism or her naivete set her up for constant happenings of a melodramatic sort. He didn't say that Velma had a husband, a therapist, an orgone box partner, a godmother, a lover, a health club masseuse, and a crew of friends to bail her out of whatever she had fallen into. He didn't say Velma was a grown woman, a wife, a mother, and not Palma's baby sister anymore. And he didn't press her into his chest to try to cajole her out of her anxiety. He did not embrace her closely and whisper any of the men-comforting things guaranteed to set her teeth on edge, remembering Sonny, her ex-husband.
Don't worry about it.
Or, you're overreacting, woman.
Or, let's talk about this calmly, baby.
Marcus didn't say anything. He left her on the sidewalk and stepped into the street, snatching off his cap, and hailed a cab. Palma was swaying on her platform shoes, staring at the velveteen shirted back of Nilda up the street, and just at that moment noticing that Nilda and Cecile were wearing each other's hats. She inhaled deeply and felt worse. The women were in front of the rib joint talking to her brother on the roof. Flames were shooting out of the chimney, but what that meant did not register. The women had stopped and were carrying on a comic conversation with the man on the roof throwing ladles of soup from a steam table bucket toward the fire, beans and onions sliding down the blackened brick of the chimney when he could get close.
Save the soup, brother. You've got a built-in hose, you know.
Much bad booze as he drink, a passerby remarked. Be like pissing pure gasoline on the flame.
Smoke billowed out of the doorway. Customers, sooty and choking, stumbled out and leaned on cars, the bus stop post, the mailbox, coughing. Palma could make nothing of it. It was all as in a dream. Then, turning on the wooden shoes to watch Marcus playing matador in traffic, the ridge in his bush from the press of his cap like a strangling band around his head, she wanted to reach out and touch him. lean out and fluff up his hair, rake her fingers in his bush the way he often raked his mustache when it was time for him to leave, to catch a plane, to go home to a situation he said little about. In the bedroom door, with his fingers making scratchy noises, covering his mouth and searching for soft words to slug her with. But what could he do? And what could she do on the sidewalk in her crazy shoes, her hand out, her body leaning, but he so far away?
"Some serious cooks on Auburn Street," Cecile was saying loudly. "Or is the establishment under siege?"
"Ultimate pig," Chesia announced. "This is where you get the ultimate barbecue, Cecile."
Palma was leaning forward, longing to bury her hands in Marcus's hair. The sidewalk was moving under her as though she were on the beach, the sand sucking away underfoot. She heard the pounding of shoes toward her as if the routed customers had heard about a fish sandwich giveaway down the block. Either the women had decided to eat somewhere else, or they were headed for her. It was not a dream, she realized, and she was falling, coming up out of her shoes, leaning toward the clouds of two purple smoke from the chemical plant stacks. And then he was there, helping her into a cab, and Cecile shouting something at her as she stumbled, cracking on her shoes, and then, settled in the back seat of the cab, Palma was centered again and angry. Felt mean, sensed suddenly that Velma was all right, just thoughtless, selfish. Velma was always all right. It was the people around her that were kept in a spin. Palma had been vacillating between anger, dread, calm, alarm, and rage the whole day. Now she settled into anger. She ought to leave a message with someone when she takes off like this. Marcus put his arm around her and nudged her bag.
"We go to your place and make some calls. Do you know this Jamal joker she's been seeing? Got his address or something?"
He was urging her to fish around for her address book.
"That'd be just like her. Her son doesn't even know where she is these days."
Palma was itching to know the place, to walk in, walk through walls, through that Jamal turkey, and knock Velma right off the sofa.
"Plan to strangle her this time for real, or just threaten, or just grumble?"
He hugged her.
"I don't know."
She handed him the spiral address book. She couldn't concentrate. She looked out of the window and tried to breathe easy. They passed Cecile and the others heading for the sidewalk cafe, but she didn't see them in time to wave. The cab passed the infirmary, and Palma scratched her head.
"We'd better check the hospitals," she muttered. "She rarely remembers to take her pocketbook when she goes out these days. That Velma, she could be anywhere, and no ID."
The cab was turning the bend at the back of the infirmary where the woods began. They passed the old tree where Minnie Ransom daily placed the pots of food and jugs of water for the Loa that resided there. Old tree. The Free Coloreds of Claiborne planted in the spring of 1871. The elders in coarse white robes gathered round the hole with digging sticks, the sun in their eyes, planted the young sapling as a gift to the generations to come, as a marker in case the infirmary could not be defended. Its roots, fed by the mulch and compost and hope the children gathered from the district's farms, nurtured further by the Loa, called up in exacting ceremonies till they buzzed in the park, permanent residents. The sapling, shooting upward past the wire and string armature those first few springs till the roots took hold and anchored, and the spinal column straightened on its own to tower upward from earth to sky, from soil to rain clouds, even when the building had been raided and burnt to the ground. The branches, reaching away from the winter of destruction toward the spring of renewal, the body letting go of its sap as the new halls and rooms were whitewashed, the branches stretching out and up over the first story as the collective mind grew. The leaves, like facts, like truths, unfolding slowly after much coaxing, season in and season out, sporting dew in crystal flashing splendor, shiny green atop, pale green beneath, the veins faint but sinewy, awaiting further fertilization. The flowers, knotty black hard, then berry brown, then lavender and luminous, promising the perfect fruit of communal actions. The old roots surfacing for a look around, tough, earth-hugging networks of fingers and limbs around the base of the tree that marked the beginning of the right-hand path that swerved past the generator sheds to join up with the left-hand path leading right under the building's windows and out toward the woods, trod yearly by the Loa, who danced and stomped unseen by those pretending not to know of spirit kinship, attended each generation by a certain few drawn to the tree or drawn to the building, called to their vocation and their roots. Messenger, teacher, healer, clairvoyant, clairaudient, clairfeelant, clairdoent. Waiting for the moment of eye-to-eye encounter and embrace, weary and impatient with amnesia, neglect, and a bad press. Called upon so seldom, they were beginning to believe their calling in life was to keep a lover from straying, make a neighbor's hair fall out in fistfuls, swat horses into a run just so, and guarantee the number for the day. They were weary with so little to perform. Weariness leaned on Sophie Haywood's spine. She was leaning over the waste paper basket in Doc Surge's office, wondering how long she'd been sitting that way, praying for her goddaughter. It had been a wave of nausea that moved her from the desk to the basket, the whole of the suede and leather seat tipping forward smoothly on its swivel base, as if to dump her. Her hat sliding forward, revealing the bald spots and bunched scar tissue at the back of her head that never seemed to heal. But something about the swing and rock of the chair, the glide of it across a bit of purple carpet on ball feet, had distracted her from the buzzing throb in her temples and the lift and drop in her stomach. Had anyone come into the office, had anyone been able to get past the shield Doc Surge had thrown up to ensure his childhood friend her privacy, they would have thought something extraordinary in the balls of paper, cellophane strips, cigar bands, and pencil shavings had transfixed the woman. Perhaps a fire, the way she held her hands cupped over the wastebasket as if for warmth. You never really know a person until you've eaten salt together, she told herself. But she'd gone through many a bitter experience with Velma, and still she was baffled. What had gone wrong? What did it mean? She had been listening for years to the starchy explanations from the quacks who called themselves guidance counselors, social workers, analysts, therapists, whose views had more to do with their own habits of illusion than anything rooted in the natural, the real. Mama May might have faith in fools whose faith resided in a science that only filled people's lives with useless structures, senseless clutter, but she knew better. They needed some way, she knew, to be in the world, to move about, to explain things, to make up things, to go on living blind. In time. And in time, Velma would find her way back to the roots of life, and in doing so, be a model. For she'd found a home amongst the community workers who called themselves political. And she'd found a home amongst the workers who called them.